Hi and welcome back again to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode, we take a tour through the 1800s. We take a huge step towards the Great Britain which we know today. The advances made through the Industrial Revolution continue well into the 19th century, and some of the developments and inventions of this coming 100-year period begin to really provide the roots for the technology and the social and cultural and political platforms which we know today. We move from the Georgian times to the Grand Victorian times, a period of our history just out of the reach of memory of those living today, though one which has perhaps been told about by grandparents or great-grandparents, and a hugely influential period of time in the history of Great Britain. Now, as we enter into the year 1800, the Parliaments of Britain and Ireland passed another Act of Union which formally joined the two nations into one, called the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. The American War of Independence was over and their own sovereignty gained, but the French Revolution was indeed well underway. After a period of hostility and fighting between the French state in turmoil and splintered under the mad Louis XVI until his execution, they turned to the young military leader, Napoleon Bonaparte. After a period of war, the Treaty of Amiens was signed in 1802, bringing an end to the conflict and the beginnings of an end to the French Revolution. Though the conflicts between France and the other belligerents in these wars were, while not military ones at times, did continue on the continent regarding the occupation of various ports and strongholds, including specifically with the British, the territory of Malta. Proposals and negotiations passed back and forth, and when no agreement was reached, the British broke the treaty and declared war once more on the French. Britain formed a coalition of allies to take on the French, including the forces of Russia and the Roman Empire, while the Spanish stood with France. There was an ever-impending prospect of a French invasion on British soil by Napoleon and his armies, and the British Royal Navy raised its efforts to protect the seas around our island and to control the English Channel. In 1805, French and Spanish fleets sailed from Cadiz for an invasion. The smaller British fleet was ready to intercept them, though, led by the great Admiral Horatio Nelson. The naval battle which took place off the Spanish coast was called the Battle of Trafalgar, just off Cape Trafalgar in southwest Spain. The British were hugely outnumbered, and not only did the Spanish and French fleet hold more ships, but they also possessed the mighty gunship, the Santissima Trinidad, the biggest vessel in the battle by some distance, able to hold 140 mounted guns. Nelson, however, took the initiative and sailed his fleet directly at the French-Spanish line, splintering their fleet into three and separating the back group. As the British fired on them and the fleet attempted to turn, that portion of the fleet seemingly surrendered and sailed rapidly away across the ocean. As the British Navy regrouped, they began to hold the advantage in the battle. In the conflict that followed, the Allied fleet of France and Spain lost 22 of their ships, while the British sailed victoriously home, having not lost a single one. The victory at the Battle of Trafalgar turned the tide of the war and cemented Nelson's place in British iconography. 1807 saw the first Act of Parliament moving Britain towards the abolition of slavery. The Slave Trade Act, as it was known, was introduced by the then Prime Minister, George Grenville, and whilst it didn't entirely abolish the practice of slavery from the British Empire, it did largely prohibit it and certainly started the process of abolition, setting the trend for the other world powers to follow. In 1810, King George III was almost completely blind due to cataracts and in constant pain due to rheumatism. He was confined to his chambers for large parts of each day, and he realised it was necessary to take steps. The following year, with the king unable to rule in any fashion whatsoever, Parliament took the steps to agree a Regency Act. The Lord Commissioners were appointed and approved to act on the King's behalf in signing royal documents with the royal seal, which was something that was only really permitted for the King to do, and they brought forth the Care of the King During His Illness, etc. Act. Under the Act, the King was suspended from the personal discharge of royal functions, and his son George, the Prince of Wales, was permitted to act in those functions on the King's behalf. George, Prince of Wales, would therefore become the Prince Regent. George, the Prince Regent, allowed the running of the country to remain with the ministers, and he didn't immediately act as though he were a new king. The government at that time was led by the Tory Prime Minister, Spencer Perceval. The next year, in 1812, the Prime Minister was crossing the lobby of the House of Commons when he was shot by an aggrieved shipping merchant from Liverpool called John Bellingham. The Prince Regent sought to pull together a government, but the insistence of the ministers on punishing and prosecuting for the war in Europe, largely against the powerful Napoleon Bonaparte, was tearing Britain apart and causing the poor to get poorer, and the government began to splinter. In 1815, Napoleon marched his armies through Europe on various fronts, and a coalition of Great Britain with the states that would form Germany, Hanover, Prussia, Nassau, Brunswick, along with the Kingdom of the Netherlands, met him on the battlefield. Leading the British charge was Arthur Wellesley, 1st Duke of Wellington. On the 18th of June, the British army took their positions outside of Waterloo in Belgium, in what was then the United Kingdom of the Netherlands. Word arrived that the Prussian forces were en route to support the British men, and the British repelled attack after attack from Napoleon's forces, and so as the Prussians began to gradually arrive at the battle, they began to chip away at the French flanks. By that evening, Napoleon pushed his army forward to the British line with one last great effort, the last battalions available to him then being the senior infantry of the French Imperial Guard. The British repelled them also. The Prussians circled around and the flanks were taken again. The battalion crumbled, and by dusk of that day the French force fell to the Allies. They harried the fleeing soldiers back, chasing them for miles and miles through the night until almost midnight before stopping, splintering the defeated men in all directions. A few years later, after it's declared that Napoleon was the sole obstacle to peace in Europe, he stepped down from his role in France and would die in 1821 in British hands, locked away in a damp house on the island of St. Helena in the middle of the Atlantic. George III died just the year before, in 1820, and the Prince Regent rose to the throne of Great Britain and his territories as King George IV. George IV was known as a gentleman. He was smart and knowledgeable, but he seemingly cared little for his role, and his gluttony would cause him to squander what talents he had. He was known to prefer a girl and a bottle more than politics or religion. He was a heavy drinker and led a flamboyant and indulgent lifestyle. His coronation had cost £243,000, while his father's had only cost £10,000. He's remembered as a keen, even if extravagant, builder, however. George was a frequent visitor to Brighton. His uncle held a home there, and he commissioned the building of Brighton Royal Pavilion in this unique mix of Indian and Chinese architectural styles. He also undertook huge works of restoration and refurbishments at Buckingham Palace. It had been the home of George III's wife, Queen Charlotte, and George IV intended to create a new, comfy home. But whilst the works there were underway in 1826, George changed the plans. And plans to change the home into a grand palace were put in place with the help of George's friend and architect, John Nash. Whilst George would never adopt the palace as his home, indeed it would be some years before the building was adopted as an official royal residence that it is today, it was vastly expensive. It took years of planning and building. Indeed, the construction project would itself outlive George. Elsewhere in British culture, we were seeing the works from the likes of Jane Austen, who wrote Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice at this time. Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. We saw the poetry of Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth and Lord Byron and John Keats. The Royal Academy of Music was founded in 1822, receiving royal charter from George IV in 1830. The National Gallery in Trafalgar Square was also opened in 1822. George Stephenson, the father of the railways, pioneered steam rail travel with his Stephenson's Rocket. Isambard Kingdom Brunel, one of the most influential and incredible figures in British engineering, was changing the country with suspension bridges and tunnels and the Great Western Railway, along with revolutionary advances in steamships and public transport. In 1829, Sir Robert Peel founded what would go on to be London's Metropolitan Police and Scotland Yard too. And so staying in London, back in the Royal House, this over-the-top, gluttonous lifestyle that the King was enjoying would soon get the better of him. Even in his later years, he drank heavily, despite being bedridden for days at a time and suffering from gout, dropsy, intense breathlessness. Physicians would frequently tap his abdomen to drain excess fluids. He suffered from cataracts, rendering him nearly completely blind. He lost the use of his hand and couldn't sign documents, and his mental health declined with it. George died in 1830 in Windsor Castle and was buried in the chapel on site. He was succeeded by his younger brother William, who was crowned William IV of Great Britain and Ireland, along also with the title of his predecessors, the King of Hanover. Nicknamed the Sailor King, he had a distinguished history in the Royal Navy and had spent much of his younger years away in the Caribbean and in North America. At 64 years of age, he was the oldest person to have ever been coronated to the throne of Britain or any of its constituent parts. William IV was the opposite of George IV in nearly every way. He was known to discourage ceremony. He had no time for flamboyance, and he was comfortable walking the streets of London or Brighton alone. Now, the process at the time was that the coronation of a new monarch would be accompanied by a general election to decide a new parliament. The Tories, led by Lord Wellington, who was then the Prime Minister, actually served twice, were defeated by the Whigs, led by Earl Grey, whose legacy is great, and it is indeed a shame to say that he's best known for having a bergamot-flavoured tea named after him. The election and the imbalance of votes and seats in the House led to the Reform Act, which began to set out huge political reforms and changes which would give better representation to the cities with the higher populations, less or none to the tiny districts which previously elected seats with very few constituents. And importantly here, it also barred women from voting entirely, classifying formally that a voter was a male person. In 1833, royal assent was given to the Slavery Abolition Act, which formally made the ownership and purchase of slaves illegal within the British Empire. The Act also provided for payments to be made to the slave owners to cover the lost cost of the slaves as business assets, half of that money going to the Caribbean and to West Africa. In his short reign, William also signed the Poor Law Amendments Act, which attempted to fundamentally change the poverty relief system, the welfare system, and also signed the Factory Act, which regulated the hours of work and the welfare of the young children who were employed in the cotton mills and the factories, providing better ventilation, sanitation, and guarding from working machinery. Whilst William's reign was indeed short, it was not uneventful, and in 1837 he died in Windsor Castle, just like his brother, and was buried there in the chapel, like his brother also. William had no children, but his favourite niece, Princess Victoria of Kent, was his chosen heir to the throne, though for the last months of William's life she was too young to reign at only 17. Just a few weeks before his death, however, the young princess turned 18, and on the 28th of June, 1838, she was crowned Queen Victoria. Victoria became the first monarch to live in Buckingham Palace, which was still in part undergoing its construction and its partial renovation. Despite being queen, the social convention at that time was that a young unmarried woman must live with her mother, and so it was. Before she was crowned, King Leopold of Belgium invited Victoria and her mother to visit, with the hopes of introducing Victoria to his nephew, Albert. Victoria was still below the age of consent to marry, and she didn't feel like she was ready to commit at that time either. But once queen, and with the clamour to find a partner, Victoria's heart began to be set on the young German Duke. When he visited the Queen in 1839, she took the opportunity and proposed to him. They were married the following year in 1840 in St. James's Palace. In 1845, Ireland was struck with a great famine, sometimes referred to as the potato famine, due to the widespread disease which took out the potato harvest. Over 1 million Irish people died in the famine, and over the next decade or so, 2 million permanently left Ireland for other lands, making it one of the single biggest evacuations of an island anywhere in history. Nicknamed the Famine Queen amongst the Irish, there are mixed reports as to how Victoria set about aiding the people there. Some record that she sent the biggest aid donation of anybody, whilst others say she donated only £5 to their cause. It's possibly somewhere between these two stories, as her intention to improve the reputation and relationship with other nations was quite notable. She was especially keen to improve relations with France. She and Albert hosted the French royalty in London on numerous occasions, and she visited them in return, the first time a reigning British monarch had done so since Henry VIII. Whilst there were still conflicts abroad, including the Crimean War, where we meet the fascinating Lady with the Lamp, Florence Nightingale, the war there was fought between the armies of Russia and a band of allies led predominantly by the Ottoman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire had been dissolved earlier in the century, in 1803, though the Ottoman Empire continued on until their ill-fated decision to side with Germany in World War II. But on the island of Great Britain, there was another explosion of cultural development. What we now refer to as Victorian Britain was beginning to take true form. Charles Dickens, the Bronte sisters, Thomas Hardy, H.G. Wells, Lewis Carroll and others were beginning a new thirst to read. Books had always been expensive to produce and thus also to buy, but libraries were springing up across the country and the population was thriving on it. Soon there would come the likes of Oscar Wilde, Robert Louis Stevenson, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Victoria's reign would give the foothold for the great sports of the country to flourish, and it was in the latter parts of the century that we see football, cricket, croquet, competitive horse riding, and the first Wimbledon tennis championships in 1877. Alexander Graham Bell invented the first audio telegraph and then the modern telephone. William Dockery established the first postage stamps known as penny post. We saw the introduction of the London Underground, also the first of its kind anywhere in the world. The first line ran between Paddington and Farringdon on what is now the Circle Line, using gas-lit wooden rails and steam locomotives. Historians often regard the second half of the 1800s as Britain's true golden age. Though if you've read a page of Dickens in your life, you'll know that whilst life was great for some, Victorian Britain was a dire place to be for many. Since the Industrial Revolution the previous century, population had increased steadily decade on decade, and as many left the rural areas and flooded into the cities, overcrowding became a huge issue. Poverty, homelessness, sanitation, crime all grew exponentially with the population increase, especially in London. Slums sprang up, some of them vast and often little more than a cobbled together collection of items which had been salvaged. Disease was rampant. Children weren't educated. In 1840, only around 20% of the children in London had received any schooling at all. The children were expected to work to contribute to the family income. Dickens himself worked in a factory from the age of 12. The children were employed in workhouses, in cotton factories, to quite fatal effect, as chimney sweeps, coal miners. Those who didn't have one of these true employment opportunities worked out on the street selling flowers or other cheap goods, shining shoes, or resorting to stealing and pickpocketing. That Dickensian picture of Oliver Twist's London wasn't far from the truth of the time. Now, India and its territories, known as the subcontinent of India, was ruled over by the British East India Company, which acted as a sovereign power on behalf of the British Crown and of Queen Victoria. In 1857, an uprising brought about the Indian Rebellion, or the Indian Mutiny. Whilst ultimately unsuccessful on the part of the Indian rebels, the rebellion resulted in the dissolving of the East India Company and the creation of the British Raj, a direct rule by the crown of the subcontinent of India. Victoria assured the citizens there that their rights would be upheld, and a few years later she would adopt the title of Empress of India, a title with the male equivalent of Emperor that would continue through to after the Second World War with the independence of India. In 1861, Prince Albert died, and the Queen was devastated. She entered a period of mourning for her husband, the man she'd loved so deeply for much of her life, and she wore black for the remainder of her life. Now, the Prime Minister at the time, and a close advisor to Victoria, was the great Benjamin Disraeli, one of the founders of the modern-day form of the Tory Party, and a great strategist. It was Disraeli who advised Victoria on matters on the subcontinent, and his foreign policy was largely endorsed by the Queen. This led to a number of overseas conflicts, including not only the wars in India, but also the war against the Zulu Kingdom in South Africa in 1879, and the Anglo-Afghan War in the Emirate of Afghanistan the same year. The Queen wrote that, quote, "If we are to maintain a position as a first-rate power, we must be prepared for attacks and wars, somewhere or other, continually." Her attitude, whilst kind in theory, was that the expansion of the British Empire across the world was a good thing for the native peoples. The presence of the British forces and the British rule a protecting force against others who may not be quite so kind. Indeed, Victoria employed two Muslims as private waiters, an act that appalled her more traditional family. She consequently employed one of them further to teach her Urdu, or Hindustani as it was known at the time. She's remembered as the short, somewhat squat, diminutive woman with the stern face. But indeed it seems that much the opposite was actually true. She was unassuming, yet she was able to control the masses. She was stern, yet she would frequently roar with laughter, and she gave love openly to those she cared for. Queen Victoria cemented her place in the annals of British history for all that she was, all that she accomplished, all that was accomplished under her rule, and whilst as flawed as any, she was honest, straight-talking, and brought the empire into the 20th century in a better place than it had been prior. As the 1800s drew to a close, Victoria had already laid out her plans for her own state funeral, anticipating what would come as we move into the 1900s. Whilst the leadership of Victoria was soon to end, the troubles for the country, as we well know, were about to get much, much worse. Next time, we move into the final episode and the period of time that we're all most familiar with, most of us having lived through some, if not most, of it. The 1900s. As we leave the Victorian era behind, we're left on the precipice of a brewing war like none that had come before it. And as that war faded and the dust settled on a global battlefield strewn with death, a second war bubbled in the old pot behind it. But once we move on from that, a time focused on peace and love followed, and the freedoms that the British people enjoyed at that time, whilst fought hard for, would pave the way for rock and roll, for counterculture, for technology and the rise of the computer age, and the new generation of today's Great Britain.